6. When we hear the news, at first it means almost nothing. It has just been announced that The Real World, MTV's seminal program involving the housing of 7 young people in one house and the televising of their lives, will film its next season in San Francisco. MTV is seeking applicants. They are looking for a new cast. At the office, we have a few hearty laughs about it. Has anyone seen the show?
No.
No?
Some of it.
We're all lying. Everyone's seen the show. We all despise it, are enthralled by it, morbidly curious. Is it interesting because it's so bad, because the stars of it are so profoundly uninteresting, or is it because in it we recognize so much that is maddeningly familiar? Maybe this is indeed us. Watching the show is like listening to one's voice on tape. It's real, of course, but however mellifluous and articulate you hear your own words, once they're sent through this machine and are given back to you, they're high-pitched, nasal, horrifying. Are our lives that? Do we talk like that? Look like that? Yes.
It could not be.
It is.
No.
The banality of our upper-middle-class lives, so gaudily stuck between the mindless drunk driving of high school, that was meant as a metaphor only, and the death that is homeowning and family-having, especially when packaged within a comfort zone of colorful couches and lava lamps and pool tables, wouldn't this make interesting television only for those whose lives are even more boring than those of the Real World's cast? But it's impossible to ignore. As half of the people we know, in secret or unabashedly, are scrambling to get their applications in, we wonder what sort of fun we can make, put our much-needed spin on it all. One of our contributors, David Milton, writes a letter to them, which we have ready for the first issue. The letter reads, "Dear producers, something is radiating deep within me and it must be transmitted or I will implode and the world will suffer a great loss, unawares. Epic are the proportions of my soul, yet without a scope, who cares am I? This is why I must, but must, be one of the inhabitants of MTV's Real World. Only there, burning brightly into a million dazzled eyes, will my as yet uncontoured self assume the beauteous forms that are not just its own, but an entire market niche's due. I am a Kirk Cameron, Kurt Cobain figure, roguishly quirky, dandified but down-to-earth, kooky but comprehensible, denizen of the growing penumbra between alternative and mainstream culture, angsty prophet of the already bygone apocalypse, yet upbeat, stylish, and sexy. Oscar Wilde wrote, "Good artists exist in what they make, and consequently are perfectly uninteresting in what they are. A great poet, a really great poet, is the most unpoetical of all creatures, but inferior poets are absolutely fascinating. They live the poetry they cannot write. As with Dorian Gray, life is my art. Oh, MTV, take me, make me, wake me from my formless slumbers and place me in the dreamy real world of target marketing. Sincerely, David Milton." And after the chuckles, and after I get over my fleeting paranoia that Milton's making fun of me in particular, we get serious for a second. We're trying to get advertising, distribution, all that flotsam lined up for our first issue, and right now we are nowhere because we have nothing and are no one. We have, though, assembled a crack team. There is Moody, of course, and now there is Marnie, who has moved out a few months out of college. Yes, in high school we had dated. Yes, she had been a cheerleader, though an improbable one, a serious one, the one who never smiled. And now she is the one among us who reads Ms., who reads The Nation, who knows what or who Che Guevara was. And there is Paul, who has joined up, having grown up 20 miles south of us along Lake Michigan, on the cold, cruel streets of Chicago's Gold Coast. We had started with one more, my grade school best friend, Flag, whom I had coerced into leaving his girlfriend and job in Washington to move to Berkeley to be a part of the startup. He had made the trip, set up with us, at a desk by the window, had spent his days doing our market research. It was just for show, soft, unprovable statistics to parade in front of advertisers. But he soon learned what the rest of us pretty much knew going in, that there would be no money in this, not for a long time at least, if ever, and the hours were going to be ludicrous, spent in a filthy corner of a shaky warehouse where dust falls from the rafters when the tenants walk above, where the locks are decorative only, where the rent sets us back $250 a month. But it's not like anyone here in San Francisco in this building is going to tell you you're wasting your time. The rest of the floor consists, with occasional musical chairings, of a desk for our landlord, Randy Stickrod, real name, who is a magazine consultant, having recently aided in the launch of Wired, the founders of which only recently vacated the precise area we are currently inhabiting and moved two floors up. Across from us is the desk organizer, and tiny computer of Shalini Malhotra, who helps with Just Go, a tiny eco-travel magazine, and who is working on her own zine, provisionally titled Hum, the Indian word for us, which will be dedicated to uniting and speaking for, to, from 20-somethings of the South Asian American persuasion. There is also Boing Boing, a neurozine published by Carla Sinclair and Mark Fraunfelder, a plastic, gel, leather, new wave circa 1984-looking husband and wife team, just up from L.A. In the back, there is a guy putting out a magazine called Star Wars Generation, no explanation necessary. Altogether, our floor, our building, it has something, is bursting, is not just a place where people are working, but a place where people are creating and working to change the very way we live. The warehouse, as luck would have it, is in San Francisco's South Park neighborhood, an area of maybe 6 blocks which, if the newspapers are right, is itself about to explode, because this is where Wired makes its home, as do a handful of other magazines, mostly computer rags, but also SF Weekly, The Nose, humor, and Future Sex, cyber erotica, naked people wearing virtual reality gear. Not to mention countless startup software companies, web developers, internet providers. And this is 1993 when this stuff is new. Graphic designers, architects, all surrounding or very close to a small oval of green called South Park. No relation. Bordered by small Victorians and bisected by an active playground, within which sits, on its perfect, lush, green grass, an incredibly dense concentration of sophisticated and gorgeous youth. A green oval teeming with the vernal and progressive and new and beautiful. They have tattoos before everyone has tattoos. They ride motorcycles and their leather is amazing. They practice, or claim to practice, Wicca. They are the luminous young daughter of Charles Bronson, who interns at Wired, where the ratio of attractive young women to interns and assistants is 1-to-1, they being one and the same. There are bike messengers who also write socialist tracts, and bike messengers who are 200-pound transvestites, and riders who prefer to surf, and raves are still attracting crowds, and the young creative elite of San Francisco are here, and only here, do not want to be elsewhere, because technology-wise, New York is 10 or 12 years behind. You can't even email anyone there yet. And style-wise, L.A. is so 80s because here, in stark contrast, there is no money. No one is allowed to make money or spend money or look like you've spent money. Money is suspect. The making of money and caring about money, at least insofar as having more than, say, $17,000 a year, is archaic, is high school, is completely beside the point. Here, there are no clothes that are not pre-worn. When a shirt is not a used shirt, when a shirt has cost more than $8, we say, hey, nice shirt. Yeah, nice, you know, shirt. And there are no cars that are not old cars, or preferably very old cars, silly cars, cheap cars. The coveted parking spaces around South Park filled with automotive mutants, anomalies. And in San Francisco, for better or worse, there are no ideas dumb enough to be squashed, or people aren't honest enough to tell people the truth about their dumb ideas. And so half of us are doing dumb, doomed things. And there is no prestige like the prestige in working for Wired, wearing one of those new black shoulder bags they just had made, or having been at the party thrown by the people from survival research laboratories who make giant robots and have them fight each other. And though the material rewards are a joke and the apartment rents are already starting to get silly, we say nothing and complain little because when the cherubic bald anchorman on the news says that this is the best place on earth, we cringe, but then kind of even believe it, in a way, believe that we have to work 18 hours a day, whether for ourselves or one of these tech startups or whatever, because we're in a certain place, are lucky, feel lucky even though it's been only a few years since the hills burned, since the highways collapsed. But so we are gathered here, each and every perfect, warm but not too warm day, each day lathered in sun and possibility, probability, and while everyone drinks their lattes and eats their burritos, pretending not to be checking each other out, there is a feeling that we are, at least at this point in time, with our friends, on this lush grass, at the very red, molten hot core of everything, that something is happening here, that, switching metaphors, that we are riding a wave, a big wave. Of course, not one that's too big, not like one of those huge Hawaii kinds that kill people on the coral. Of course, we and our magazine can't let on that we're part of this scene, or any scene. We begin to perfect a balance between being close to where things are happening, knowing the people involved and their patterns, while keeping our distance, an outsider's mentality, even among other outsiders, ridiculing other magazines, especially Wired upstairs. We do a what's hot, what's not list. What's hot? The sun, flambé, branding irons, lava, molten. What's not? Snow, vichyssoise. A cold beverage. Lava. Hardened. We place an ad with the local media organizations, saying that we are not this and we are not that, that this will be, unless something bizarre and terrible happens, the very first meaningful magazine in the history of civilization, that it will be created by and for us 20-somethings. We try alternatives to no avail. People in their 20s, people of 20. That we are looking for writers, photographers, illustrators, cartoonists, interns. Anyone who wants to help will be put to work. We need hundreds, can use thousands. We send in the listing manifesto, and in days, hours, a cascade of resumes. Most just out of college, some with pictures drawn above their names, designs in the margins, transcripts from their years at Bates, Reed, Wittenberg attached. We call everyone, can't call them quick enough. We want to marry every one of them, are thrilled to have found them, to have made this connection. We offer work to everyone. What kind of help do you need? They ask. What do you want to do? We say. What kind of hours will it require? What kind of time do you have? We'll take anything, anyone we can get, no matter what kind of loser they are. We don't care, even if they went to Stanford, Yale. For us, it's all about numbers, amassing sheer numbers of people. Most who come have other jobs, and many, thank God, have no jobs at all, and have been given by their parents a year or so to get on their feet. Every time someone walks through the door and steps over our garbage and around our boxes looking to offer themselves, we have met a brother, a sister, already believing so fervently in the utter urgency of what we're doing. I saw your notice, and I just fucking had to come down. It's about fucking time someone did this. Great, thanks. Now, I've got some poetry. And though we can't accommodate everyone's talents, proclivities, and agendas, about 5 different people want to write about the many, many uses of hemp, we know that we have something, have touched a nerve. We want everyone to follow their dreams, their hearts. Aren't they bursting like ours? We want them doing things that we will find interesting. Hey, Sally, why work at that silly claims adjusting job? Didn't you used to sing? Sing, Sally, sing! We feel sure that we speak for others, that we speak for millions. If only we can get the word out, spread the word with this magazine. We will make the magazine a platform from which to spring, a springboard from which to speak. We write the premier issue's opening essay. Could there really be more to a generation than illiterate, uninspired, flannel-wearing slackers? Could a bunch of people under 25 put out a national magazine with no corporate backing and no clue about marketing? With actual views about actual issues, with a sense of purpose and a sense of humor, with guts and goals and hope? Who would read a magazine like that? You might. That's where the pun comes in, that last part. To fund a second phone line for the fax machine, we hold bake sales in the park. All the contributors bring goods, and we raise about $100. We beg everyone we know to switch to working assets for their long distance. But you have to. They donate money to good causes. And they say if we get 100 people to change over, they might advertise and... We seek out alliances with others, like us, who are taking a formless and mute mass of human potential and are attempting to make it speak, sing, scream, to mold it into a political force. Or at least use it to get themselves in Time and Newsweek. There is Lead or Leave, a Washington, D.C. political group which already, in 1993, claims some 500,000 members. There is Third Millennium, a similarly minded advocacy group, one born of a weekend brainstorming session held at the family getaway of one of the young Kennedys. Both organizations want to amass their own thousands, register voters, and become the youth version of the AARP. Then, once the numbers are marshaled and the weapons distributed, they'll fight the war that we all must fight. The war that will become our great war, or at least our Vietnam. Social Security. It appears, from the calculations of many economists, that when we are all 65 or 70 or whatever, when we retire, there will not be enough money left in the pot for us, that Social Security will be bankrupt. Lead or Leave and Third Millennium make news everywhere by registering voters and holding press conferences to call attention to this looming Armageddon, and we make contact with these organizations, pledge solidarity, though to be honest, we have absolutely no idea what they're talking about, though we share with them the desire to motivate and bring to action some kind of action, though what exactly we are not sure. Our 47 million souls, what we are most interested in is their mailing list. It's not like we don't support them, because we do, conceptually, if not materially, or ideologically. It's just that, given little to no contact with economic insecurity of any kind, we have a hard time finding the fire in the belly for such things. We want to join them in complaining about the burdens of student loans, but then remember that, of all of us, only Moody had to take one on. We want to complain about jobs, but we don't really want jobs ourselves, not the kind you'd complain about. So quickly fall mute. And Social Security? Well, personally at least, I cannot in my wildest fantasies see myself making it past 50 or 55, so find the issue moot. All we really want is for no one to have a boring life, to be impressive, so we can be impressed. We try to convince people that we're a lifestyle magazine. See, we're talking here about a style of life. Huh? Get it? Not lifestyle, like lifestyle. Life style. A style of life. Right. A style. Life. We find strength in people doing things we find worthwhile, heroic, and we are getting great press for doing such things. We lionize Fidel Vargas, the youngest mayor in the country, whose politics we know nothing about, but whose age, 23, we do. We glorify Wendy Kopp, at 25, the founder of Teach for America, which places recent college graduates in understaffed or financed schools, mostly urban. We love people like this, those who are starting massive organizations, trying new approaches to age-old problems, and getting the word out about it with great PR, terrific publicity photos, available in black and white or color transparency. We are willing and ready. Whomever we need to ally ourselves with, whatever we need to do, we will be there. If we have to organize events and sponsor speakers, if we have to go to large, loud rock concerts and sit at tables and hand out literature and look down the loose-neck tank tops of late teenage girls, even if we have to appear on television and in magazines and be quoted extensively and live like rock stars and wield power like messiahs, whatever it takes, we are ready. Just tell us where to be, who we're talking to, the circulation of your newspaper or approximate viewership, and a vague idea of what you want us to say. It's like the 60s. Look, look, we say to one another, at the imbalances, the glaring flaws of the world, aghast, amazed. Look how things are. Look at how, for instance, there are all these homeless people. Look at how they have to defecate all over the streets, where we have to walk. Look at how high rents are. Look at how the banks charge these hidden fees when you use their ATMs. And Ticketmaster. Have you heard about these service charges? How if you charge your tickets over the phone, they charge you like $2 for every goddamn ticket? Have you heard about this? It's completely fucking ridiculous. But soon it will be okay. When we begin publishing and put in the 6 months or so until world domination, these things will be addressed, redressed. We look at portfolios. As I sit down with a comely photographer named Deborah, I see not only a possible dating possibility, but also an image that immediately screams the theme song of our message. In her book is a picture of a stark, naked man streaking across a beach, blurry with speed. This is the cover, I say. Okay, she says, and I wonder if this will help my chances with her. The streaker on the cover spawns another idea. We too will be naked. Yes, on the cover will be Deborah's streaking boyfriend, a live-in, alas, and on the inside will be hundreds of streaking young people. We will imitate the light and look of the first one, but aha, it'll be hundreds of us, all running together on the beach, a herd of bare and hopeful flesh, sprinting from left to right, of course symbolizing all the things that would obviously symbolize. We call Deborah and set it up and then start calling about for naked models. We call friends, everyone we know. The idea gets scaled back. We don't need hundreds. How could we have fit hundreds in the frame, anyhow? We only need a few people. 10, maybe. 8. 5. Of course, we'll be there, for starters. So Moody, Marnie, and me. Now to diversify. We are obsessed with seeming diverse. Not in terms of actually having an incredibly diverse staff or anything, but in terms of appearing diverse. Thus, when photo opportunities arise, we panic. We must look like the perfect cross-section of young America. For the cameras, we need 3 men and 3 women, 3 whites, 1 black, 1 Latino, 1 Asian. But instead, we have just us, 3, 4 white people, and not even a Jew. For the naked shoot, we need an African-American, a Latino, a Latina, whatever. We need somebody Asian. Lily says no. Ed, a circulation expert guy we know at Wired, who is black, says no. Desperate, we wonder, would Chalini, being Indian, pass for a more well-known minority? Would she show up in a blurry picture as clearly of color? Will you? No, she answers. We call June. June Lomena is our black friend. She works occasionally in the building for one of the other magazines, had stopped by to say hi one day, and had subsequently written something oblique about male-female relationships for the first issue. And did we mention she's black? She also might be Latina, we think, because of the name and all, but then we do not ask. She is by training, at Brown, an actress, and so when we ask her to run around naked, she readily says yes. So there are 4 of us. Everyone else we know refuses. We finally find 1 more guy through a friend who we figure will be good because his head is shaved. We can't pay you, we say. That's okay, he says. We do not know why he wants to do this, to get in a car with 4 strangers and run naked on a beach and be photographed doing it. And come to think of it, we do not want to know. So then we are on the beach, Black Sands Beach in the Marin Headlands, on an unseasonably cold October morning. We have just become naked and have noticed that, right where the 5th guy's regular penis is supposed to be, there is a penis with a gold thing through it, like a needle or a nail or something. It's hard to tell without staring. When I glance at it, I feel woozy. As a reverent and terrified Catholic, I hadn't seen my penis until my teens, hadn't touched it until college, so to see this, which I didn't even know was being done. I turned my attention to Marnie's breasts, which look different unclothed than clothed, and, come to think of it, are kind of uneven. June looks normal, lithe and strong, certainly the only one among us with everything perfectly in place. Then I try to discern if Moody's penis is noticeably bigger than mine, and decide that, at least flaccid, it's a draw. Just about. Good. Good. We are young and naked and on the beach. Deborah gets set up, sitting on a log facing the water. We get a 20-yard head start, and then we run past her along the shore at full sprint. We try to space ourselves out so when we pass her, we will be spread out, everyone visible, all colors and sizes. It will be beautiful and poetic, and it hurts like a motherfucker. Our penises flop up and down, and then as we pick up speed, slap left to right, back and forth. Who would have thought left to right? The pain. People should not do this. Penises were not built for running. I think of a distended muffler scraping the pavement. I think of a bird shaking the life out of a worm. The agony is ridiculous. We run past her, she gets maybe 2 frames off, and then we do it again, 12 times at least. I begin to hold my penis for the majority of the run, letting go only when passing directly in front of her. I can't imagine what it's like for the pierced penis guy. It's definitely not helping to keep it in place. If he had some kind of hookup, like to his navel. We do one where we run away from Deborah and straight into the water, which is frigid, as always. Then we get dressed and go home. When we get the pictures back, we are all hopelessly blurry, and the pertinent demographic efforts we have made, 2 women, 1 black, are barely visible. All the running past her pictures were unusable, meaning that all the penis abuse was for naught. We are left with the last picture, that which shows all of our bare asses running into the Pacific. We use that one. It is the last picture of the first issue's opening six-page spread, a visual montage that precedes the manifesto reprinted earlier. Each page has a grid of sorts with photographs abutting each other, and over each picture is typeset a word. To wit, over a picture of a spoiled-looking young woman, nope. Over a display of guns for sale, nope. Over two Cupid dolls in marriage gear, nope. Over a televangelist extolling his flock, nope. Over a detail of the rape of the Sabine women, nope. Over a close-up of a young man sneering, nope. Over a bunch of women's high-heeled business shoes, nope. Over a close-up of a collar and tie, nope. Over Adam and Eve being expelled from the garden, nope. We are fairly convinced that what we have here is a work of such powerful genius and prophecy that it may very well start riots. Should the meaning prove elusive, a key. We are not spoiled and lazy. We do not think guns should be sold at counters. We are not for marriage or religion. And we're definitely against rape and sneering and heels. Same with ties. And also being expelled by God from gardens or being ashamed of being naked. Or eating apples. This last one was unclear. Then, in the spread, after all this negativity, all the things that we reject out of hand, is the kicker, the finale. A full-page photo of five people running, naked, their backs to the camera, into the ocean. Over that picture, emblazoned in black against the sky, this is in black and white, is one word. Might. Boom. In general, we are sure that we are onto something epical, and our work hours reflect this. They are tests of will and examples of the deleterious effects of peer pressure and guilt. Because as non-traditional as we clearly are, we begin to keep standard daylight hours, 9 to 5, and add to them 2 or 3 bonus rounds, depending on what needs, for the sake of ourselves and mankind, to get done by the next day. It must be done. Waiting is obscene. During the day, Moody and I do our graphic design work, primarily for the San Francisco Chronicle's internal promotions department. Moody is still doing other marketing work, and I am still temping, usually at the Pac Bell headquarters in San Ramon, where I spend 8-hour days designing certificates commemorating exemplary achievement. Marnie is waitressing 4 nights a week, but increasingly our bills are being paid by the Chronicle, the heads of which took pity on me early on. The eyes of Diane Levy, a single mother of a teenage daughter, welled up when I told her that I, too, had a youngster at home. And now they count on us to do ads, posters, and campaigns that promote the paper's various sections and columnists. We do the work with the radiant acuity for which we are known. We need an ad for the business section, they say. Sure, we say. The result? The Chronicle. Make it your business. Now one for the sports section. Chronicle Sports. We know the score. We are tired of such misuse of our creative powers and have decided that we will not wait to raise money this way to fund Might. While we tell anyone who asks that Might was started on overworked credit cards, on the runoff from our graphic design business, the terrible, unspeakable truth is that I simply wrote a check. It was about $10,000 for the first print bill, constituting a hulking portion of the insurance and house money that came my way after the estate was settled. I thought, at first, that we should tell everyone the truth. What better metaphor for our endeavor? Rising from the ashes, literally, of our parents, this smallish amount of money enabling us to do it the way we want, to save us from having to sell the idea to others, to raise money, or to abandon it altogether when it would become obvious, as it surely would, that no one would put such funds behind such a ridiculous enterprise. But this way, there is no waiting for approval. This way, there are no strings. Moody and Marnie know that this is how the magazine has been funded, but no one else is told, ever. Maybe they wouldn't understand. Maybe they would understand all too well. After that first investment, though, future contributions will be minimal, as the operation begins almost immediately to pay for itself, though hopes for it paying us are very dim and far away. Then again, things could change quickly. Things could turn around if, say, we weren't just a bunch of anonymous half-wits putting out an underfunded zine, but rather the same half-wits, admittedly, but one of whom was the star of a widely watched and wildly influential MTV real-life revealing television phenomenon. We get applications. Marnie and I decide we'll both apply. We fill out the short questionnaires. As required, we both make videotapes of ourselves talking and doing something that we hope they will find diverting. Some people skateboard, some tap dance, introduce their families, play with their dogs. For mine, I sit at my desk in the warehouse and Moody videotapes me as I talk about nothing, and then, kind of suddenly, I start drumming, epileptically. I do a routine where I'm the drummer for Loverboy, who for some reason couldn't drum without blinking and twitching like he was sitting on loose wiring. The videotape is kind of funny, we think. It's likely more scary than funny, but Moody laughs. We send it in. 2 days later, a woman, Laura, calls. She is one of the show's producers or casting agents or whatever, and she has obviously recognized me as the sort of person who belongs on TV, inspiring a nation of disaffected youth. I am to go into the new Real World headquarters for an interview, half an hour or so, which will also be videotaped. The interview is on a Sunday. As Toph is still sleeping, I drive in from Berkeley, over the bridge, miles above the water, to the makeshift MTV offices in North Beach, next to the Embarcadero, and, appropriately enough, lodged among a good portion of the city's ad agencies. I am filled with pride and terror. Of course, I wanted to be asked to audition, wanted them to see all there is to see in me, but I had no real intention of following through with it at all. And now that I'm actually going through with it, I'm petrified someone, Beth, Toph, David Milton, will find out. I convince myself that this is just for sociological or journalistic reasons. What a funny story this will make. When I arrive, the neighborhood is deserted and I am 20 minutes early. Because people who appear on MTV are not early, are not anxious and responsible enough to be early, I walk around until it's time. When I'm 2 minutes late, I walk in. The office, only a few weeks old, already has, over the receptionist's desk, a huge, perfect MTV logo fashioned from corrugated steel. As I wait, the young assistants chat with me, attempting to make me feel comfortable. While waiting and chatting, I realize that, duh, I'm already auditioning. I begin to think harder about my words, making them more memorable, wanting to be at once fun, cutting edge, soulful, and Midwestern. I notice my legs, they're crossed. But how to cross my legs? The guy-guy way or the woman's older man's way? If I do the latter, will they think I'm gay? Will that help? Then a woman walks in, glides in. She looks down at me. She is my mother, my girlfriend, my wife. It is Laura, the producer, casting person who called. She has an Ally McGraw look about her. Her skin lightly tanned, her eyes dark with straight, milk-chocolate hair, soft on her shoulders, a velvet curtain touching a velvet stage. She invites me into another room where she will conduct the interview. I follow. I am ready to give myself to her. She will listen, and when she listens, she will know. But my hair is probably all wrong. I meant to check it in the bathroom beforehand, but didn't get a chance. Ridiculous. On what could be the most important day ever for me, for my hair, I leave it to chance. And if I asked to check it now, she'd think I was vain, self-conscious. And we can't let her get the wrong idea. Of course, maybe she wants someone vain. I could be the vain person. There's always someone vain. Of course, they're usually models. I could never qualify, never. Unless I was one of those Benetton models, strange and homely. I could do that. Odd-looking, but defiantly so. Like the heroin people are the ones with freckles and huge hair. That could be me. Oh, look at her. More than I want to be on Laura's show, I want to settle down with her, to raise a family with her, on 10 or so acres on the North Carolina coast. We'll have a dog named Skipper. We'll cook together, for her parents, for the neighbors. Have a crowd of kids that look not like me, but like her, with strong, delicate features, that wonderful nose. Okay, she says, sitting down behind the video camera. The tape starts, the red light, everything. Where did you grow up? She asks. Oh, I know this. A little suburb of Chicago. Lake Forest. It's about 30 miles north.
I know Lake Forest.
Really? I say, feeling a format change coming, one where quotation marks fall away and a simple interview turns into something else, something entirely so much more. It's just a little suburb, about 17,000 people. I'm surprised that Please, Lake Forest is one of these towns like Greenwich or Scarsdale. I mean, isn't this one of the wealthiest towns in America? Is it?
Well, I guess it is. I guess. I don't know. But I didn't know any rich people. We weren't rich. My friend's parents were teachers, sold medical supplies, ran frame shops. My parents drove used cars. My mother bought all of our clothes at Marshall's, that kind of thing. We were on what I guess would have been the town's lower socioeconomic half.
What did your parents do?
My mother didn't work until I was about 12, and she was a teacher, Montessori. My father was a lawyer, a commodities-oriented lawyer in Chicago, futures trading.
And your siblings?
My sister's in law school at Cal. My brother Bill works at a think tank in L.A.
What does that mean?
Well, he started out at the Heritage Foundation, traveling Eastern Europe, advising the former Soviet republics, whatever they're called, on conversion to free market economies, etc., etc. Then he wrote a book about downsizing government here, at the local level. It's called Revolution at the Roots, Making Government Smaller, Better, and Closer to Home. You should see it. It's even got a quote from Newt Gingrich right there on the cover, something to the effect that all Americans, if they're good Americans, should read this book. I take it you two don't talk politics much.
No, not too much.
And did you have money growing up?
I don't know. Sometimes, sometimes not. We were never really lacking for anything, but my mom had a way of making us feel like we were just scraping by.
"You're driving us to the poorhouse," she would yell, usually to our dad, but also to anyone, to no one in particular. We never really knew what was going on, but it would be ridiculous to complain. We lived in a house in this nice town, had our own bedrooms, clothes, food, toys, went on vacation in Florida, though we always drove, mind you. We all worked from the time we were 13 or so, all summer. Bill and I cut lawns. Beth was up at the Baskin-Robbins and Brown Cords. Of course, had to buy our own sad, short-lived used cars, rabbits and rusty Camaros. All went to public schools, state schools for college. So, no, I wouldn't think of us as having much money. There was certainly never anything saved. We found that out when they died.
Hmm.
So, am I on?
What do you mean?
Did I make the show?
Am I on?
Wait a second, we just started.
Oh.
So, did you feel different? Were there social divisions based on wealth?
Hardly.
But if there were, it was an inverse relationship. The kids who acted and dressed like they had money were outcasts, were pitied, weren't really allowed to be popular. It's just like anywhere. Children in public schools are trained, have it pounded into them by their peers, that to stand out is to attract possibly unfavorable attention. So being obviously wealthy was the same as being too tall, too fat, having a boil on your neck. We all gravitated toward the middle. This was the case all through school. The richest kids were usually seen as the wannabes, were the most desperate, were constantly throwing parties to get the attention of kids whom everyone really envied, like the guy on the football team who lived in the old wooden house behind the high school. The popular kids drove trucks, bought the shittiest cars, had parents who were divorced or drunk or both, who lived far from the areas considered desirable. The rich kids, like the ones whose shirts were always tucked in, whose hair was always just so, or those who went to the private schools in town, were considered hopeless, troubled, eccentric. I mean, can you imagine being in a town like Lake Forest with these excellent public schools and still blowing 10 grand a year to send your kid to a school called Country Day? These were the freaks. You know what we called that school?
No.
It was pretty funny.
What did you call it?
Country Gay. Country Gay, get it? Country Gay!
This was a fairly intolerant town?
Homogeneous, yes. Intolerant, no. It was overwhelmingly white, of course, but racism of any kind, at least outwardly expressed, is kind of gauche, so we basically grew up without any sense of prejudice, firsthand or even in the abstract. With the kind of wealth and isolation we had from societal sorts of issues, crime, outside of the vandalism perpetrated by me and my friends, was unheard of. The town was free to see those kinds of things as a kind of entertainment, wrestling matches being contested by other people in other places. The only instance I ever knew of any truly bigoted stuff was when I was in grade school and this one thin, geek-looking kid with glasses moved in down the street and on the corner, and in his room he hung one of those flags. The Southern flag?
The Confederate flag.
Right, So this kid, who was my brother's age, 3 years older, moved in when I was about 9 and almost immediately turned everything upside down. First, on the bus, my brother Bill saw him draw a swastika on the back of a seat. None of us had ever seen firsthand something like that, and thus it became the big story for a while. An actual racist! Then, the kids started an informal kind of club, a little group of other kids from the neighborhood, and then they all started drawing swastikas on their notebooks and using the word that people used for these purposes. What word? I might get it wrong. The word is kike, right? Yes. Is that K-Y or K-I? I think K-I. Huh. I would have thought K-Y. But so suddenly, that was a word kids were using. We were this enclave of civilization suddenly corrupted by, it was backward in a way, with the arrival of this sort of missionary of bigotry. Anyway, one of the neighborhood kids, this guy Todd Golub, was up until this time friends with the rest of the neighborhood kids, but then suddenly he was Jewish, and immediately he was off limits. Of course, I didn't ever hear much of it myself. These guys were older, my brother Bill's age, so I'd hear small bits from Bill, and even then the information was discouraged, my parents not wanting us really to know anything about it all. Bad kids, my mom said, and that was that. We knew absolutely nothing. I didn't know any profanity, knew nothing about sex, anything. I was 12 when I realized balls referred to testicles and not the two cheeks of your butt. Don't laugh, I was terrorized for that kind of thing. At that point, I had the Catholic knowledge of my own anatomy, meaning none at all. I digress. So Bill tried to hold on to these kids as friends in some way, hoping this swastika stuff was just some temporary viral thing. But just from what I knew, I started having these elaborate fantasies about what went on in the kids' house. Whenever we'd drive by, I'd crane my neck back, looking for that big Confederate flag. You could actually see it pretty easily. It covered the entire window of the kids' room, draped so it sagged in the middle. I had no idea what to think, how deep it ran in that house. So when we drove by, I half expected to see him and his dad out in front, burning crosses, hooded men tossing nooses over tree branches. I really did. We had no frame of reference. This kid was exotic in the same way that the kids who lived in apartments were. I just had no way to process the information. Our town was rigid in many ways, in terms of the uniformity of things, the colors of skin, the makes of cars, the lushness of the lawns. But on top of that, it was sort of a blank canvas, so... And again, I guess this is true of any child. I was ready to quickly accept the sudden and total substitutions of all I knew to be true. What about black kids? We had a few. Maybe 4, 5 at a time. Growing up, in grade school, there was Jonathan Hutchinson. He lived on Old Elm Road, an east-west thoroughfare that acted as the border between Lake Forest and Highland Park, not far from our house. He was okay. A sort of awkward kid, but nice enough. Then he moved away, and for a while there weren't any black kids. Then Mr. T moved in. Mr. T? Yeah. This was, God, I think we were in junior high or just in high school, and it was after the A-Team had been off the air for a year or two when we heard about it. Jesus, then it was all anyone could talk about. The town was still reeling from ordinary people being filmed there and all. There were all these pictures of Robert Redford at the McDonald's, but we never had anyone on the level of a Mr. T. I mean, at the time, he was still this massive star. I forget what he was doing right then, maybe between series or something. You know how hard that can be, but... Still this huge star? He moved into this enormous place on Green Bay Road, easily 10 acres or so, with a gate and a big brick wall facing the street. The place was right near town, a few doors down from our church, St. Mary's. And how was his arrival met? We lost our brains! Our world exploded! We fucking loved it! The kids, that is. I mean, the A-Team had been by far our favorite show. We threw 18 parties, used to run around the 7th grade cafeteria singing the theme song while spraying the girls' table with imaginary fire. But our parents, I think now in retrospect, were a bit more cautiously enthusiastic. First of all, those with money don't want to seem impressed by fame, especially ill-gotten fame, which is what I assume was the thinking in T's case. You don't mind if I just call him T? Not at all. After all, this guy was a bouncer when he was discovered. And of course, he didn't help matters when he started cutting down all the trees. I think I remember this. It made news all over. It was a scandal. Here you had this supposedly uptight white town, and then this large black man with the gold chains and the mohawk comes in and takes this chainsaw and cuts down literally all but about 2 trees on his property. About 200 of them, probably, all in plain daylight by himself with the chainsaw. It was incredible. The nerve! He said he was allergic. But that didn't really fly. See, this was a town that really took pride in its trees, and for good reason. We had some nice goddamn trees. We had the signs all over, Tree City, USA. We love those signs. So then he cuts down all these trees and everything, and no one really knows what to say because they want to condemn him, and some did. But the vast majority of people were kind of afraid of looking racist or, like, poor sports or something. This was a place where the black janitor got a standing ovation when he sang Deep River in the talent show. So everyone eventually just sat back and watched. My dad thought the whole thing was hilarious, loved reading about the debate, giggled wildly about it. Oh, fantastic, he'd say, whenever the town was being embarrassed by the Chicago newspapers. He never identified with Lake Forest, had no friends in town, didn't drive the right kind of car. So we actually saw him once, Mr. T. When we were on our way to church, saw him right there in front of his gate with the chainsaw. Amazing. He was doing the shrubs. How was it that we started talking about all this? Black kids. Well, he had 2 daughters, and they went to the high school. So when they showed up, they immediately doubled the black student population, brought it up to 4 students. I think it was 4. How many kids were in your high school? About 1,300. And this is only 20-odd miles from Chicago? Right. And there was actually a town to the north, maybe 5 miles away, called North Chicago, which was mostly black, I think. How do you mean, you think? Well, I've never been there or anything. I have been to Highland Park, that's the Jewish town, and used to buy beer in Highwood, which was where all the Italian restaurants were and where all the Mexican men who cut lawns lived, and there was a mall in Waukegan, I think, always full of sailors, and Libertyville was where the kids with the hockey haircuts lived. So how were Mr. T's girls treated? Everyone seemed to like them, as far as I could tell. They were supposedly very nice and kind of funny, but I didn't know them at all. Didn't, and don't, even know their names, actually. They were a year younger. They were always driving around in that white Mercedes of theirs, all customized with those plates, Mr. T 3. But everyone liked them okay. They were Mr. T's kids, after all, and as such were a source of great pride for the school, at least as far as us kids went. It was the first thing we told anyone, really. That and about ordinary people. They were the only black kids? The only other black kid I remember was a guy in my sister's class, this guy Steve, whose last name I don't know, never did. Not that I would really know much about anyone in my sister's class, but the thing with Steve was that because he was the only black guy in their class, he was known simply as Steve the Black Guy. Pardon? Yeah, to hear my sister tell it, that was basically his name in all contexts. His handle, if you will. He was just this average guy, not incredibly popular, but nice enough. And so people liked him, and people, I guess, thought it was this odd novelty that he was different. Odd in the same way that it was odd how the one kid had a crew cut, or how that one girl, I forget her name, she hung out with the basketball players. What was her name? She was a dwarf. But so he was Steve the Black Guy. So this was oppressive. How do you mean? No. Did you like it? Yes, I did. Many did not. Many complain about it. Many are ashamed to say that's where they grew up. People in Chicago and Champaign can be rough when you tell them. They'll bow, kiss your hand, but I won't apologize for having been brought up in what was, at least in my part of town, a pretty simple suburb. Trees and a creek, nice parks. It's not like we had a choice, that at 8 or 9, whenever we could have left home, moved somewhere less horribly fraught with this hideous prosperity. I should say, though, that like any seemingly stable and contented context, one with a certain stability and attention to detail and respect for family, comfortable but deeply Midwestern, this was. At the same time, it was very quiet sometimes. Oddly quiet, and underneath the quiet there was the tiniest, faintest sound, like air being let out of a narrow hole, a sound like someone screaming from worlds away. And people were dying in dark and bewildering ways. How do you mean? Oh, suicides, weird accidents. One kid I knew growing up was apparently in the basement poking around and a stack of wood fell on him. He suffocated. That was our first death. He was 10, maybe? Then, like, 2 years later, Ricky's dad.
Ricky's dad?
Ricky was one of my best friends, lived just across the creek. It ran just behind both of our houses. And he and Jeff Farlander and I used to do stuff together. We're on the same swim team, everything. It was strange across the creek. Most of the things we did together involved some sort of vandalism, come to think of it. Throwing stuff at cars, ice, rocks, crabapples, acorns, snowballs. In retrospect, I have no idea why. Did we resent the passing of these cars? We were bored and loved the thump of a projectile hitting a passing car, truck, whatever. It kept escalating. First, just the throwing of things, then one winter, we built, using 7 or 8 full-size snow boulders we rolled from fresh snow, a complete snow wall in the road. We lined them up, packed them together, and watched from the bushes, giddy, giggling. It was a 3-foot-tall, 3-foot-deep wall right on Valley Road, created, because we were very bright and the police knew our handiwork, right in front of Jeff's house. It worked as designed, though, with drivers either stopping and turning around or stupidly plowing through it, underestimating the wall's depth and craftsmanship. "There goes the transmission," Jeff would say. "Yep," I would say, having no idea what he was talking about. I knew nothing about cars. One summer, we went further. We'd always done stuff with lighters and gasoline, lighting this or that. The usual object was to soak a tennis ball in gasoline, light it, and kick it around the street. "Fireball!" we would yell. "Fireball! Fireball! Fireball!" Guess what we called that game? I give up. We called that game Fireball.
I see.
But one night, a fourth kid, Timmy Rogers, a rangy, stringy-haired kid a year older than us, had the idea that what we do see would be to take the gasoline and pour it across the street. But we didn't have any matches. Someone would have to go home and quietly get some, not arousing suspicion. But as we were figuring out who would go and who might have those long-stemmed barbecue matches, Timmy Rogers just took out his lighter, a tiny Bic lighter, leaned down to the gas-soaked pavement. By this point, I was literally jumping out of range, and lit the thing. The whole street going up at once. Incredible. Flames 5 feet high. The streets of Lake Forest burning. It didn't last long, not at all, but long enough to attract the police, who came and poked around as we chuckled in the bushes. We lit the street on fire. Then we went back to Jeff's and watched Used Cars for the 6th time.
What does this have to do with Ricky's dad?
Oh. It was a clear day in the early summer. I was at home, building a Martian city out of Legos, matching it to the intricate architectural plans I had drawn out in my sketchbook, next to my drawings of flying dinosaurs and friendly aliens with big feet. I had all the foundations laid out, on the gray cratered base plates I had gotten for my birthday. Then Jeff called and said we had better go over to Ricky's house because something terrible had happened.
What happened?
Ricky's dad doused himself with gasoline and lit a match and then ran around the yard on fire and then stopped running and then it died right there in front of the house. I told my mom, then walked down the street to the dead-end part, jumped across the creek where it was shallow, went over to Jeff's, and then we walked to Ricky's. He was in the family room, watching TV. His family room was like ours, wood-paneled and dark. He said hi. We said hi. There was one of the early music video shows on, this was before MTV, and they were showing a video for a Bob Dylan song called Joker Man. We liked the video. There were things hurtling toward the screen like in 3D. I just started reading Rolling Stone and had heard of this Bob Dylan and knew if I was to know anything, I had to know and like Bob Dylan. And so I really wanted to like the song, but then Ricky beat me to it.
"I like this song," Ricky said.
I was kind of pissed. I decided to let it go. Ricky's two little sisters, much younger, floated in and out of the room from time to time. We watched more TV, sitting close to it.
"What did it look like?" Jeff asked.
I couldn't believe he asked.
"You know what it looked like?" Ricky said. "It was like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. We knew just the part, the very end, where the Nazis open the Ark of the Covenant and the spirits come out.
The spirits that are at first pleasant and beautiful but then turn angry, and flames come from the Ark and kill all the Nazis, impaling them with stiff ropes of fire where they stand, and then the head Nazis, one by one, melt like wax dummies, the skin, then cartilage, then blood running off their skulls in order like differently colored waters. It both terrified and fascinated us. Wow, we thought, Raiders of the Lost Ark. We sat with Ricky, sat there for a while watching TV, and then got bored and went out into the front yard to see if there were any marks anywhere on the grass or blood or anything. But there was nothing. The lawn looked perfect, lush and green. And why are you telling me this? I don't know. These are the stories I tell. Isn't that what you're looking for? These terrible deaths tearing through this pristine community, all the more strange and tragic given the context, the incongruity. So tell me something. This isn't really a transcript of the interview, is it? No. It's not much like the actual interview at all, is it? Not that much, no. This is a device, this interview style, manufactured and fake. It is. It's a good device, though, kind of a catch-all for a bunch of anecdotes that would be too awkward to force together otherwise. Yes. And the point of the anecdotes again? Well, the point of the stuff about Lake Forest should be fairly obvious. It grounds us in a certain world, in a world that will be familiar to many people, especially those who've had the privilege of seeing ordinary people, with Timothy Hutton in a breakthrough role. Best Picture, 1980. The passages describing suicides are formative experiences, of course, which foreshadow both my assumption that I and those I know can be reasonably expected to die in absurd and dramatic ways, and also foreshadows things that happen in the second half of the book. The stuff about race and ethnicity is supposed to make clear the kind of context we grew up in, where there was an incredible amount of homogeneity, where we were deeply embedded into that, in contrast to Toph and me in Berkeley, where there's this outrageous kind of diversity, though within which, ironically enough, we still feel very strange, outside the mainstream. So that's about inclusion and exclusion. The anecdote about Sarah. Sarah? Who's Sarah? Oh, I meant to get that in earlier. Let me do that quickly. We found out about my mom's situation in between my junior and senior years in college, having been gathered by Dad in the family room. That summer was just a mess. I did some weird things that summer and that fall. Lots of just simple drinking-based things and some breaking of things, the clawing at the walls while dreaming. And I started going home from parties in strange cars, drinking with not good friends. One humid summer, I went to this one party at this guy Andrew Wagner's place. He lived in an old wooden house across the highway, kind of remote. And he used to have these massive parties, the outdoor sort that were hard to have in Lake Forest, with so many alert and vigilant police officers at work. And I went there with Marnie and a bunch of her friends. They figure in a little later when I go back home to look for my parents. And drank a lot. Keg beer in shiny red cups, the thick kind with the white inside. Soon, it seemed soon, but probably wasn't, the people I came with were leaving. Marnie asked me if I wanted a ride, but I said no, that I was talking to Jeff Farlander, that I'd stay. I was talking to Farlander for the first time in years. We'd grown up together. I'd stayed at his house for days at a time. His house was the first place we went when things were bad at home. His mother was the closest thing to an aunt. You know what I mean. Jeff and I had drifted in high school, but at this party, Andrew Wagner's party, under the withering porch lights and both of us full of keg-pulled Schaefer, we caught up, punched each other in the arm, everything. When the party was moving from Wagner's to this bar called McCormick's, Jeff and I decided that I'd be going with him.
You'll come with me, he said.
Yeah, yeah, I said. I wanted to be 11 again, with him, throwing eggs at cars. But then, as we were walking to his car, I ruined it and said, Jeff, my mom's dying. Just threw it out before I knew what I was doing. No, that's not right. I knew what I was thinking, had thought of it, had been thinking of telling him all night as we talked under the porch light, because he knew her, was there from the beginning. I kind of sprung it when we were walking to the car, and he slowed down, and in his scratchy voice, scratchy even when we were very young, said, I know. And so, on the way to the car, we were both crying, but just for a second, and then we got in his car and drove on the highway through town, past Lake Forest and Lake Bluff, and to McCormick's, a roadhouse sort of bar on the way to Libertyville in Waukegan. The lot was full. Everyone, from football players to their hangers-on, and anyone, really, had been coming here for years. I had never been. Inside, it was full, and I was struck by the fear that if Jeff knew, everyone there would know. There would be silence, gasping, snickering. But no one said anything. We walked in, and there was that one stout, apple-cheeked guy bartending, Jimmy Walker. There was that Hartenstein guy, huge, older, who once played for the Bears. And there was Sarah Mulhern. Uh-oh. We had almost grown up together, Sarah and I, had been on the same swim team when I was 9 and she was 11, run that swim team for some years after, but we had never once spoken. She was older and a better swimmer, and a much better diver. I was a liability to that swim team, to the diving team. I was a slow swimmer and a hapless diver, wouldn't do an inward, couldn't even pull off a 1.5. She could do it all. Inwards, 1.5s, doubles, back 1.5s, whatever. Always with her legs together and toes pointed in that little splash at the end. She was on the medley relay, always won her heats, was the name everyone knew, the name that was broadcast over the loudspeakers. But I never talked to her. Not in junior high or high school. The 2 years that separated us were too many. And her hair was too straight and blonde. And I had not yet developed the tools to mentally or physically handle the sort of curves she was working with. But then there she was. Sarah Mulhern, at the bar, and I have no idea how I began talking to her, or much of what we said, but then Jeff was gone, and I was getting into the back seat of a car with Sarah, driven by Sarah's friend. The car smelled of smoke and old vinyl. Sarah smoked. Then we were in her bed, in her parents' big house, and there was some of this and that, but I passed out before. I woke up in a canopy bed, and she was already awake, watching me. The furniture and walls were drenched in yellow-white, as if not only the walls, but the air itself had been painted. We sat on our floor and talked about grade school, about the retarded kids who we were told to treat kindly, who would die young. We played records, talked about the fall. She was trying to be a teacher, had gotten her certificate and was doing some tutoring. Then we snuck out through the garage. Her parents were home, and she drove me home. As we sat in my driveway, I wanted to say so many things, that I was actually dating someone else, Kirsten, and that what I had done was a mistake, a terrible crime, that I had slipped because I was confused. But then I saw a figure through the window, someone sitting up in the family room looking at us, and didn't want to explain about my mother to Sarah, and didn't want to explain Sarah to my mother, so we kissed quickly and I jumped out. That's Sarah. Yes. You know, the great thing is that this format makes sense in a way, because an interview where I opened all this up to a stranger with a video camera actually did take place. MTV could conceivably still have the tape. The application had said, "We will not be able to return the tape to you, and a portion of it could end up being aired in conjunction with the series. Your signature on the application gives us the right to do this." And besides, squeezing all these things into the Q&A makes complete the transition from the book's first half, which is slightly less self-conscious, to the second half, which is increasingly self-devouring. Because, see, I think what my town and your show reflect so wonderfully is that the main byproduct of the comfort and prosperity that I'm describing is a sort of pure, insinuating solipsism. That in the absence of struggle against anything in the way of a common enemy, whether that's poverty, communists, whatever, all we can do, or rather, all those of us with a bit of self-obsession can do, wait a second, how many of you do you think are so self-obsessed? There's actually two ways the self-obsession manifests itself. Those that turn it inward and those that turn it outward. For instance, I have this friend John who just channels it all inward. He talks about his problems, his girlfriend, his poor prospects, how his parents died, on and on to the point of paralysis. He literally isn't interested in anything else. It's his whole world, the endless exploration of his dark mind, this haunted house of a brain. And the other kind? The people who think their personality is so strong, their story so interesting, that others must know and learn from it. Let me guess here. Well, I pretend I'm the latter, but I'm really the former, and desperately so. But still, my feeling is that if you're not self-obsessed, you're probably boring. Not that you can always tell the self-obsessed. The best sort of self-obsessed person isn't outwardly so, but they're doing something more public than not, making sure people know that they're doing it or will know about it sooner or later. I guarantee that the applicants for the real world, I guarantee that if you put all these tapes in a time capsule and opened it in 20 years, you'd find that these are the people who are, in one way or another, running the world. At the very least, they'll be the most visible segment of the demographic, because we've grown up thinking of ourselves in relation to the political, media, entertainment ephemera in our safe and comfortable homes, given the time to think about how we would fit into this or that band or TV show or movie and how we would look doing it. These are people for whom the idea of anonymity is existentially irrational, indefensible, and thus there is a lot of talking about it all. Surely the cultural output of this time will reflect that. There'll be a lot of talking, whole movies full of talking, talking about talking, ruminating about talking, about wondering about our place, our wants and obligations, the blathering of the bel epoque, you know, environmentally reinforced solipsism. Solipsism? Of course. It's inevitable. It's ubiquitous. You see it, right? I mean, am I the only one seeing the solipsism? That was a joke. Yes, yes. So, what do you think you can offer this show? Well, see, I've thought a lot about this, and I'm figuring I've got it happening two ways. First, I can be the tragic guy. Second, we've got this magazine. Right. Now, what's it called again? Might. M-I-T-E? No, M-I-G-H-T. Everyone spells it M-I-T-E. It's ridiculous. Why would it be named after a bug? Might is such an obscure word compared to might, right? Well, what is it named after? Well, it's a double entendre, see? You'll love this. This is great. It can mean two things at once, can sit right on the fence between two meanings, with, in this case, might meaning both power and possibility. Oh, yeah, I know. It's good. And what's it about? Well, see, that's what's great. It'll be this perfect match. It's geared to the same demographic that you're reaching. We're trying to make clear that we aren't just a bunch of people sitting around farting and watching MTV. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with MTV, really, but you know what I mean. So yeah, I get on the show films us putting this magazine together, reaching millions, defining the zeitgeist, inspiring the world's youth to greatness. Do you work a lot? Yes. How much? I don't know, maybe 70 hours a week, 100 maybe? I don't know. We all do. We punish ourselves for our comfortable childhoods. Marnie probably more than all of us. She waitresses at a restaurant in Oakland, one in San Francisco, but still keeps up with the rest of us. But that's good, right? Young people working hard to, you know, achieve their dreams, striving for greatness. That's good TV, yes? Well, or not. We're flexible. I mean, I could work less. I could work part-time. I could let the other people do most of the work, whatever. You tell me. Well, that would be something we'd have to talk about. Right. Does that mean I got the part? I've got it, right? Don't I shine through the fog of the rest of these loser applicants? All these boring people? I mean, isn't it all perfectly clear now? Don't you want the tragic person? The tragic person. Right. There's 7 cast members, right? Yes. So let's work this out. First, you'll get a black person, maybe two. They'll be hip-hop singers or rappers or whatever. And then you'll get a couple of really great-looking people who will be nice to look at, but completely ignorant and prone to terrible faux pas of taste and ignorance. Their presence serving two purposes. They, A, look wonderful on screen, and B, also serve as foils to the black person or people who will be much sharper and savvier, but also easily offended and will delight in raking the dumb people over the coals week after week. So that's 3 or 4 people. You'll probably throw in a gay guy or a lesbian to see how often they can get offended, and maybe an Asian or Latino, or both. Or wait, a Native American. You should get a Native American. That would be so great. No one knows any Indians. I mean, I've never met an Indian. Actually, there was that one guy in college, Cletus, who said he was 1/16. But so you need to get one who's easily offended, not a passive sort. You need someone who'll actually care about and debate the tomahawk chop, the Redskins and everything. That'd be great. So, let's see. That's 5 or 6 people so far. Then you'll need a really straight professional type, a doctor or something, a lawyer maybe, someone in grad school. And then me. The tragic person. Right. I realize I seem much too average at first. I'm white, not even Jewish, my hair is horrible, and I'm poorly dressed and everything. I know how blah that seems. Suburban, upper middle class, two parents. Why do we seem so boring, all of us? Are we as utterly boring as we seem? It certainly didn't help with my college admissions experiences, let me tell you. But you need someone like me. I represent tens of millions. I represent everyone who grew up suburban and white. But then I've got all these other things going for me. I'm Irish Catholic and can definitely play that up if you want. And then the Midwest thing, which I don't need to tell you, is pretty valuable. And if you want to go hardcore rural, play that angle. I went to school in the middle of a cornfield, have seen cows, smelled their waste every day. There was a south wind. And oh, it was a state school. So I can be the average white suburban person, Midwestern, knowing of worlds both wealthy and central Illinoisian, whose looks are not intimidating, who's self-effacing but principled, and this is the big part, one whose tragic recent past touches everyone's heart, whose struggles become universal and inspiring. It must be hard. What? Raising your brother. How do you know about him? It was on your application. Oh, right. Well, no, it actually isn't hard at all. It's like, do you have a roommate? No. Have you ever? Yes. It's like that. We're roommates. It's easy. It's actually often easier than it would be with a regular roommate because you can't tell a regular roommate to sweep the hall or go get some margarine. So it's the best of both worlds. We entertain each other. So no, it's not. Oh, but if it needs to be, it can be. It can be hard. Actually, yes, it is hard. Very hard. Well, how do you plan to manage being on the show? How do you mean? With your brother and all. Oh, right, right. Well, I've talked it over with my sister, and she'd be willing to pick up the slack for the duration of the show. She lives only like a block away. Wait, how long does the filming go on for?
About 4 months.
And I'd have to live in the real world house?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah, I mean, I could do that. We talked about it. We made a deal, Beth and Toph and me, from the beginning. The deal was that we do everything we could to keep everything normal. To maintain, actually, more normalcy than we grew up with. But at the same time, we wouldn't feel obligated to make the all-encompassing sacrifices that our mom had made, that had, for all intents and purposes, killed her, we felt.
On your application, you said it was cancer.
Well, sure, technically, but it was stomach cancer, which is extremely rare. Its provenance unknown, and Beth and I, we're the ones who ruminate on such things, while Bill has moved on, is mentally much healthier, by all appearances completely normal. Beth and I got to thinking that its contraction, the development of this cancer, was due to her internalization of all her stress, her many burdens, all the combat within our family over 20-odd years, it coming down to her to... It was like, in a way, it was like a soldier jumping on a mine to save his... Maybe that's a poor analogy. I mean, she swallowed the chaos, sequestered it there, and there it festered and grew and darkened, and then was cancer.
Do you really believe that?
Sure.
Kind of. You were saying about the deal?
The deal was that while Beth and I were holding together and starting over and creating a world of relative order and giving Toph as normal a life as possible under the circumstances, if opportunities arose that we would do everything we could to, the point is that we would not use each other to use obligation as an excuse to say no to things, at least not if we could still manage. I mean, you have no idea how thoroughly we shelter him from absolutely everything. Honestly, like, he's never even heard more than a few swear words in his life. But we've agreed that we'll do whatever we can to facilitate the things we want to do. We'll not hold back and become bitter and years later blame him or each other, right? Oh, wait, that's a funny story. There was a word my mom used to call us sometimes that I only figured out in high school. I'll try it out on you. Okay, the word was mata.
What's a mata?
You're good. Oh, I should have seen that coming, but seriously, that's what I always wondered. When we were sulking about something, or if we had a cold and complained about going to school, we were forbidden from staying home, by the way, never missed a day until late in high school. My mom would say, "Oh, don't be such a mata." We always assumed it had something to do with being sullen about something we hadn't gotten. Then in high school, I figured it out. The word was mangled by her Boston accent.
Martyr.
Right. The word was martyr. Of course, my mom was one of the great martyrs of all time.
About the show.
Right. In terms of the real world, I figured that I'd still see Toph all the time, but he'd live primarily with Beth for that period. She'd probably move into our place and sleep there and everything, with me being there as often as I could. Probably not that much less than now, really. I mean, I have it all pictured, the traveling back and forth between the show and my world in Berkeley, the camera crew maybe with me in the car, following me driving home each night, or whenever, the music going in the background, me making the trip home to be with him like the divorced dad. You see the potential, no? It would be sort of touching. And then he'd occasionally come into the real world house with me. It'd be great. He'd be good on TV.
How would he feel about it?
I'm sure he'd love it.
Is he comfortable in front of a camera?
Not really. He's kind of shy, actually.
My heart is pure. I know what you're thinking.
I know what I mean.
Excuse me?
Nothing.
Why do you want to be on the real world?
Because I want everyone to witness my youth.
Why?
Isn't it gorgeous?
Who's gorgeous?
Not like that. No, I just mean that it's in bloom. That's what you're all about, right? The showing of raw fruit, correct? Whether that's in videos or on spring break, whatever, the amplifying of youth, the editing and volume magnifying what it means to be right there at the point when all is allowed and your body wants everything for it. It's hungry and taut, churning and energy vortex, sucking all toward it. I mean, we're in the same business, really. Though we take vastly different approaches, of course, your real world being kind of brutally obvious, no offense, whereas the videos, at least, don't purport to be anything but what they are. But you guys, your show claims to do more, but then has a strange ability to flatten all the depth and nuance from these people.
So, why are you here?
I want you to share my suffering.
You don't seem to be suffering.
I don't?
You seem happy.
Well, sure, but not always.
Sometimes it's hard.
Yeah, sometimes it's so hard. I mean, you can't always suffer. It's hard to suffer all the time, but I suffer enough. I suffer sometimes.
Why do you want to share your suffering?
By sharing it, I will dilute it.
But it seems like it might be just the opposite. By sharing it, you might be amplifying it.
How do you mean?
Well, by telling everyone about it, you purge yourself, but then, because everyone knows this thing about you, everyone knows your story, won't you be constantly reminded of it, unable to escape it?
Maybe, but look at it this way. Stomach cancer is genetic, passed more down the female side of our family than otherwise, but because according to Beth and me, my mother was done in by dyspepsia, the dyspepsia caused by swallowing too much of our tumult and cruelty, we are determined not to swallow anything, to not keep anything putrefying down there, soaking in its juices, bile, eating bile. We are purgers, Beth and I. I don't hold on to anything anymore. Pain comes at me and I take it, chew it for a few minutes, and spit it back out. It's just not my thing anymore.
But if the information is in the eyes of everyone you meet,
then there's that much more sympathy coming back at us.
But it'll get old.
Then I'll move to Namibia.
I
am an orphan of America.
What?
Nothing. Someone else said that years ago.
So, about the dilution.
This is where the lattice comes in.
The lattice?
The lattice that we are either a part of or apart from. The lattice is the connective tissue. The lattice is everyone else. The lattice is my people, collective youth, people like me, hearts ripe, brains aglow. The lattice is everyone I have ever known, mostly those my age or thereabouts. I know little else, know only 6 or 7 people over 40, know nothing to say to them. But my people, we are still there, still able, if we start right now. I see us as one, as a vast matrix, an army, a whole, each one responsible to one another, because no one else is. I mean, every person that walks through the door to help with might becomes part of our lattice. Matt Ness, Nancy Miller, Larry Smith, Shelley Smith, no relation. Jason Adams, Trevor Makarowicz, John Nunes, on and on. All these people, the people who come to us or we come to, the subscribers, our friends, their friends, who knows who, People who have everything in common, no matter where they're from. All these people know all the same things and truly hope for the same things. It's undeniable that they do. And if we can bring everyone to grab a part of the other, like an arm at the socket, everyone holding another's arm at the socket, and if we can get everyone to, instead of ripping this arm from the socket, instead hold to it tight and thus strengthening, then I'm like a human ocean moving as one, the undulating, the wave-making, or like a snowshoe.
A snowshoe?
You wear snowshoes when the snow is deep and porous. The latticework within the snowshoe's oval distributes the wearer's weight over a wider area in order to keep him or her from falling through the snow. So people, the connections between people, the people you know, become a sort of lattice. And the more people, good people, they must be good people, who know that they are here to help, the more of these people you know and that know you and know your situation and your story and your troubles or whatnot, the wider and stronger the lattice, and the less likely you are to fall through the snow. Right. That is a mediocre metaphor. Yes, I'm working on it. You have no problem being inside a fishbowl. I feel like I'm already inside a fishbowl. Why? I feel like I'm being watched at all times. By whom? I have no idea. I've always felt like people were watching me and knew about what I'd been doing. I imagine it started with my mom and the way she had of... She had amazing eyes, these small, sharp eyes, always narrowing to a squint and tearing into you. She never missed anything, whether she was there seeing it or halfway around the world. She missed nothing. That's why, for instance, I like bathrooms. I like bathrooms because usually, while inside, I can be almost sure, at least more sure, that no one is watching me. I take great comfort in places where people cannot watch me. Windowless rooms, basements, small rooms. I have a pretty good hunch that people are always watching me or thinking of watching me. Not all the time. Probably very rarely are they actually watching me, but the point is, the important thing is that it could be any time. That's the crucial part, that at any time, someone could be watching me. I know this.
How do you know this?
Because I'm always watching people. When I watch people, I too look through them. I learned that from my mother. To glance is not enough. Eyes and brains together, acting like a flock of ravenous birds, flapping, tearing, poking. I know everything about people when I look at them for only a moment. I can tell from their clothes, their walks, their hair and hands. I know all the bad things that they've done. I know how they've failed and how they will fail and how miserable they are.
And people are doing the same to you?
Maybe.
So what do you do?
Stay inside. Bedrooms are safe sometimes, if the door is closed and the blinds are down, but if the watchers are in trees, they can see certain things. Windows are fine to look out, but harrowing to stand in front of. Even if you check and find that there are no people watching, the people watching can be somewhere not immediately visible. They can be beyond the reach of the naked eye. People use telescopes, binoculars. I have used telescopes, binoculars. People can be in closets. Closets should be checked. Large cabinets should be checked. It only takes a second. In large trunks, open doors are to be avoided. Bathrooms are good. The only problem with bathrooms is the possibility of one-way mirrors. Years ago, I checked all the mirrors in our house to make sure that there were no windows behind them. With people watching, there were none.
You're exaggerating.
Okay, you want to hear a sad story? Last night I was home, listening to an album. A favorite song came on, and I was singing aloud, loud enough for it to matter, but not loud enough to wake up Toph, sleeping in his bedroom adjacent. And as I was singing, I was moving my hands through my hair in a weird, obsessive sort of way, like a slow-motion shampooing maneuver. It's something I do with my hair when I am alone and enjoying music. And as I was singing and doing the slow-mo hands-in-hair maneuver, I messed up the words to the song I was singing, and though it was 2:51 in the morning, I became quickly, deeply embarrassed about my singing gaffe, convinced that there was a very good chance that someone could see me. Through the window? Across the dark? Across the street? I was sure, saw vividly that someone, or more likely a someone and his friends, over there was having a hearty laugh at my expense.
That must drive you insane.
Oh, please. What would a brain do if not these sorts of exercises? I have no idea how people function without near constant internal chaos. I'd lose my mind.
Are you sure you want to be telling me all this?
All what?
About your parents, the paranoia.
What am I giving you?
I am giving you nothing. I am giving you things that God knows, everyone knows. They are famous in their deaths. This will be my memorial to them. I give you all these things. I tell you about his legs and her wigs. I do so later in this section. And relate my wondering if I should be having sex with my girlfriend in front of their closet the night of my father's service. But after all that, what, in the end, have I given you? It seems like you know something, but you still know nothing. I tell you, and it evaporates. I don't care. How could I care? I tell you how many people I have slept with, 32, or how my parents left this world, and what have I really given you? Nothing. I can tell you the names of my friends, their phone numbers, but what do you have? You have nothing. They all granted permission. Why is that? Because you have nothing. You have some phone numbers. It seems precious for 1-2 seconds. You have what I can afford to give. You are a panhandler, begging for anything, and I am the man walking briskly by, tossing a quarter or so into your paper cup. I can afford to give you this. This does not break me. I give you virtually everything I have. I give you all of the best things I have, and while these things are things that I like, memories that I treasure, good or bad, like the pictures of my family on my walls, I can show them to you without diminishing them. I can afford to give you everything. We gasp at the wretches on afternoon shows who reveal their hideous secrets in front of millions of similarly wretched viewers, and yet, what have we taken from them? What have they given us? Nothing. We know that Janine had sex with her daughter's boyfriend, but then what? We will die and we will have protected, what? Protected from all the world that, what? We do this or that, that our arms have made these movements and our mouths these sounds? Please. We feel that to reveal embarrassing or private things like, say, masturbatory habits, for me about once a day, usually in the shower. We have given someone something that, like a primitive person fearing that a photographer will steal his soul, we identify our secrets, our past, and their blotches with our identity, that revealing our habits or losses or deeds somehow makes one less of oneself. But it's just the opposite. More is more is more. More bleeding, more giving. These things, details, stories, whatever, are like the skin shed by snakes who leave theirs for anyone to see. What does he care where it is? Who sees it, this snake and his skin? He leaves it where he molts. Hours, days, or months later, we come across a snake's long shed skin, and we know something of the snake. We know that it's of this approximate girth and that approximate length, but we know very little else. Do we know where the snake is now? What the snake is thinking now? No. By now, the snake could be wearing fur. The snake could be selling pencils in Hanoi. The skin is no longer his. He wore it because it grew from him, but then it dried and slipped off, and he and everyone could look at it.
And you're the snake?
Sure, I'm the snake. So, should the snake bring it with him, this skin? Should he tuck it under his arm? Should he?
No.
No, of course not. He's got no fucking arms. How the fuck could a snake carry a skin? Please. But, like the snake, I have no arms, metaphorically speaking, to carry these things with. Besides, these things aren't even mine. None of this is mine. My father is not mine, not in that way. His death and what he's done are not mine, nor my upbringing, nor my town, nor its tragedies. How can these things be mine? Holding me responsible for keeping hidden this information is ridiculous. I was born into a town and a family, and the town and my family happened to me. I own none of it. It is everyone's. It is shareware. I like it. I like having been a part of it. I would kill or die to protect those who are a part of it, but I do not claim exclusivity. Have it. Take it from me. Do with it what you will. Make it useful. This is like making electricity from dirt. It is almost too good to be believed that we can make beauty from this stuff.
But what about privacy?
Cheap, overabundant, easily gotten, lost, regained, bought, sold.
But what about exploitation? Exhibitionism?
Are you Catholic?
No.
Then why are you talking about exhibitionism? It's a ridiculous term. Someone wants to celebrate their existence and you call it exhibitionism? It's niggardly. If you don't want anyone to know about your existence, you might as well kill yourself. You're taking up space, air.
What about dignity?
You will die, and when you die, you will know a profound lack of it. It's never dignified, always brutal. What's dignified about dying? It's never dignified. And in obscurity, offensive. Dignity is an affectation, cute but eccentric, like learning French or collecting scarves. And it's fleeting and incredibly mercurial and subjective, so fuck it.
So it's all fodder. As my mom was dying in the family room,
I would periodically go into the living room, which, oddly enough, got most all the light the house received, and sitting on the white couch there amid all of her dolls, I would write what I would say at her service. I had the piece of paper hidden under the couch, a scrap of folded notebook paper. I would go there, fish it out from under the couch, and consider what I would write.
And your mother was in the family room?
Yes, she was there. At this point, half gone with morphine. My sister and I expected her to go at any point, really, and so every morning, or any time we had left her alone for more than half an hour, would race into the room wondering if she'd already be gone. Actually, we wouldn't race into the room, not wanting to alarm her, annoy her, because she would immediately know what we were doing. So we would race to the family room, and then we would stand, peeking into the room, watching her chest, fixating on her sternum, until it moved, and we knew she was breathing. Sometimes it was an excruciatingly long wait, and other times, if she had a blanket over her or something, we would have to go further, would have to lean close and search her face for movement. That went on for weeks. But after a while, particularly when she had lost all consciousness, it was just her breathing, and we started wondering about timing.
How do you mean?
Well, you can't help start wondering about timing things as well as possible. Like, everyone was home from college for Christmas break, and we really wanted it all to end before everyone went back. I wanted everyone there, had pictured it 100 times, all my friends in their suits and dresses, filing in, heads down, sitting as a massive group in the middle. And as a matter of fact, that winter break, they were thinking the same way. They were hoping she'd go while they were home. But she just kept going and going. Beth started calling her the Terminator, which I thought was kind of tacky, but, you know, as we're talking, I can see my reflection in the camera's glass, and I can tell I don't look right. I am sneering involuntarily. My lips curl, my forehead furrows. Jesus, I am not telegenic. That's going to be a problem, isn't it?
So, about the speech.
Yeah, so I'd be there writing the speech on the couch while my mother was in the other room. Because the couch was white and I was always dropping my pens, I was writing in pencil, putting it in my mouth, revising, starting again. I wasn't sure what angle to take. I didn't know where to start. At her childhood? Should it be a biography of her? A few telling anecdotes? I began again and again. But what I settled on was more about what I felt about her death and where it left me.
Interesting.
Yeah, at the time I figured it would be best that way. I let Bill talk a little about her life, about what a good mother she was, some specifics of her personality. He went off on one of his tangents about how she always supported our collecting habits, how he had collected trains, I had collected bears, Beth, dolls. Of course, it seemed radically insufficient. I mean, how can that work? A life summed up in... So I was sitting there, and as Bill was talking, I was staring at Father Mike, our priest, to whom I was supposed to give a sign to indicate that I actually wanted to get up and speak, because in the days before the service, I could not decide. But I had prepared a speech, had finished my bit the night before, late, in the dark, in the living room, and so as Bill was talking, I looked at Father Mike and caught his eye, and even as I was giving him the nod to indicate that I did have something to say and wanted to share it with the assembled, I immediately wanted to back out again and simply let the whole thing be over, so we could jump into the car, my father's Nissan, it being packed and in the parking lot, and just drive to Florida, be at least halfway by midnight. But then Father Mike was introducing me, and I got up and...
What?
You just jumped.
Nothing. Something just occurred to me.
Anyway, when I spoke, I filled everyone in on exactly how cheated we felt, I felt. But I was merciful. I said something to the effect that, you know, I could stand here and grouse about how she'll never see my children, about how unfair it all was, her being taken a month after my father, about how hard it all was for us. But then I said, my voice getting shakier, that we shouldn't think such sad thoughts, that we should just pick a bright star in the black sky and think of her, and then to find another close by and think of my dad. Yeah, I know. It's horrible. It's cheap and small. And worse, I drew a picture of her on her deathbed.
But what does that...
She was at that point long gone in terms of consciousness. She mumbled every so often, sometimes sat up with a start, saying something, but otherwise it was just breathing, gurgling, the candles, her hot skin, and waiting, really. We sat there day and night, trading places, Beth and I, with Toph downstairs usually. Beth and I sitting, watching, holding her hot hand, sleeping there, sometimes draped over her,
waiting for the near end so we could gather and then wait for the end end. And during it all, in the dark, one night, sitting on a chair to her left, I felt compelled to draw a picture of her with a red grease pencil on large drawing paper. I sketched it out first, lightly relating the rough shapes, making sure it all would fit on the page, making adjustments. It seemed like I would run out of room on the left. I moved her head farther to the right so I could fit the whole pillow in the frame. I roughed out the loose shape of the bed, the metal frame, and then I started with her face, actually. I usually don't start with the face because if you can't find a likeness, it corrupts the rest of the drawing, I find. But her face this time was easy, it having a kind of simple geometry and profile, sunken as it was, just barely rising from her pillows, flat from whatever process it was that was making her face sink and flatten, shiny from the jaundice and the excretions coming through her skin, the excretions that would have been exiting her body elsewhere had the necessary systems been working. Then I drew the tubes, the IV, the bed's aluminum railing, the blankets. When it was done, it was fairly accurate, a nice picture, with a good deal of detail in the middle, less as it reached the paper's edges. I still have it, though it's frayed on its sides. I've never been good about preserving drawings. I keep them, but abuse them. This drawing, for example, of maybe 10,000 I've done in classes or otherwise, could easily be the most important one I've ever done or will ever do, but I just looked for it and found it sticking halfway out of an old portfolio, torn at its corner. How can I be so careless with this memory of my mother? And why did I even draw it in the first place? I mean, what does that mean? It could be a purely sentimental... I wonder. But I also remember thinking of taking pictures. At the time, I was painting a lot from photographs and thought that they'd come in handy later, photographs, that I would take a bunch from different angles and use them as source material later. But you didn't. No. To be honest, I didn't really even strongly consider doing so, but the point is that I thought of it. And then you went to Florida. After the service, we spent 20 minutes or so at a tea and cookie sort of thing in the rectory and then said goodbye. My then-girlfriend Kirsten was there, and Bill, and my Uncle Dan, and after a while we sort of said, see you all later, love you, and then took off, completely wired with adrenaline, driving until midnight, stopping in Atlanta. The next day we drove until there was sand along the highway, and we were in Florida, and we brought new bathing suits and got sand in the car, car that our dad would under no circumstances ever let us drive or allow food into, and watched HBO at night in the hotel room, and Toph and I played frisbee during the day on a white, white beach, and the wind was warm and wet, and we called Bill at night and thought about visiting a few relatives we had down there. Tom and Dot, I mentioned that before. But then didn't, because they were old, and for the time being, we were done with such people. And then I never gave them a proper burial. Excuse me? What does that... I don't know where they are. What do you mean? They were cremated. They decided, I guess together, God knows why, and from where the idea came, that they would donate their bodies to science. We had no idea why. It didn't really gel with any long-held beliefs that we knew them to have. We had never heard them talk about it. My dad was an atheist, we knew that. My mother claimed he worshipped the great tree, so in his case, it makes some sense, the body donation plan, but... My mother was very Catholic, far more romantic, emotional, superstitious even, maybe, when it came to such things. But all of a sudden, the orders were there. I can't remember if we knew before or after. It must have been after his death and before hers, come to think of it. And that's what happened. After, they were taken to the coroner's or wherever. At some point, they were picked up by a donor service and brought to this or that medical school where they were used for God knows what. This disturbs you? Well, of course. At the time, we thought it was kind of noble. It surprised us, the donating, so with everything sort of spinning out of control, we just rolled with it. I suppose in part because it made arrangements easier. What do you mean? Well, the casket and all. Or lack thereof. You didn't have a casket? No. Nothing. We had services for each, of course, but we didn't bother with the casket, considering it would be empty and all. So... There was no standard funeral ceremony, like at a cemetery? No. They have no gravestones. They have no gravestones. We have no idea where they are, as a matter of fact. I mean, the people from the body donation company promised that after they were done, they would cremate the bodies and then send them to us, but they haven't. At least not yet. It was supposed to be within about 3 months, but now it's going on about 2 years.
So you don't have the remains?
Right. Actually, it's kind of funny. They don't call them remains. They call them cremains. But we still think the ashes might be coming. Beth thinks they haven't been returned because we've moved a few times. She thinks they probably tried to contact us and couldn't find us because we moved to the Berkeley sublet, and then again, and so threw them out or whatever. I kind of think they might still be there, somewhere.
Have you tried to contact the donation service?
No. I think Beth has. It's something that we talk about every couple of months, actually, but less and less frequently. It's hard because the later it gets, the farther from that time we find ourselves, the more impossible it becomes to even broach the subject. It's kind of embarrassing, really. For me, at least. That and the lack of the gravestones, the lack of funerals, the selling or disposing of most of the contents of the house. It was all such a blur, and we were moving so far, and there was so much to be done. I was trying to finish college, commuting back and forth, 3 days in Chicago and 4 in Champaign, all spring, and Beth had to do everything else, trying to sell the house, get the estate sale figured out, finding a school in Berkeley for TOEFL, paying all the bills, selling Mom's car. We were convinced that we would be forgiven anything, really, any lapses in judgment, any mistakes, all the horrible mistakes, some of the stuff we sold.
You regret all that?
Sometimes.
Sometimes Beth and I agree that it's best the way we cleared out, the clean break we made from home, from most elements of the...
You know, it was weird, but a few people frowned upon our taking TOEFL away and moving to California, thinking that the best support network would be there, in Lake Forest, blah, blah.
But good Lord, we could not get far enough away. We're sure that we'd all end up this sad local legend, these sorry celebrities, and TOEFL, this ward of the town.
No way. And so we didn't do a cemetery funeral or anything, didn't bother with coffins. Beth always says how our parents did not want a funeral, that the whole funeral and gravestone thing was just a racket, was this ridiculous tradition rooted in commerce, a Hallmark holiday sort of thing, and besides, it was much too expensive. So we can ease our conscience with that, and by assuming that we carried out their wishes.
Do you think they really wanted it that way?
No, not for a second. Beth does. Beth is sure. Beth was there. But I honestly think they can't believe we haven't buried them yet, that we don't even know where they are. It's appalling, really.
Maybe.
But I really think that embalming dead people, dressing them up, putting makeup on them, it's brutal, medieval. There's a large part of me that really likes the idea of them having sort of disappeared, just gone, with us never really seeing them once they passed on, that they just floated away or something. That because they were not buried, that might be...
Do you dream of them?
My sister dreams of them constantly, all the time. And in her dreams, our parents are often cheerful, talking and walking and saying interesting things. I have not seen my parents talking and walking and saying interesting things since they died. When we talk about it, when we are not fighting about responsibility and all, my sister and I sit on the couch and she tilts her head and twirls her hair around her finger and pieces together her most vivid dreams. In most of them, our mother is doing something simple like driving or cooking, and when she dreams of my father is skulking around or has just killed someone or is chasing her. But every so often, a dream with him in it is a nice dream. And thus I'm jealous, because I'd love to see them walking and talking again, even if it was fabricated in a dream. But I don't dream of them. I have no idea why not and how to remedy that problem.
Why not just think about your parents just before bed?
That would seem to be at least one way of doing it. I've tried that. I mean, I've tried to try. For instance, right now, I'm thinking, yeah, I'll do that tonight. Thanks for reminding me. But somewhere along the line, I will forget. It's happened 100 times. Why can't I remember to think of my parents before I sleep? Why can't I simply leave a note on the pillow? Think of parents. Why can I not do this? I mean, the rewards would be so great. For instance, if I were to think of my mother just before I fall asleep, there's a fairly good chance that my dream would bring her to life. The making of dreams, as we all know, is often that crudely predictable, and yet I can't bring myself to do it, to remember, to do the basic work necessary. It's flabbergasting. Actually, I have dreamed of my father once, sort of. In the dream, I am driving on Old Elm, a street near our house, and it's winter, no snow, just gray. I'm driving down the hill from 7-Eleven to home, and I suddenly see, maybe 200 yards away, along a parallel road, through a million bare twiggy trees, a car. Exactly like my dad's.
It's a gray Nissan something-something, and in it is a gray-haired man wearing an old brown suede coat, looking almost exactly like my father, except that even in the dream, I'm sort of doubtful that it's him. In the dream, I know he's gone, and that what I'm seeing must be a coincidence or a mirage, but then suddenly, it occurs to me, this is where in the dream even it both conforms to logic and departs wildly from it, it occurs to me that he could very well be alive still, that his death made so little sense in the first place, was so sudden and illogically timed that, and then the other factors conspire together, that none of us were there when he finally died, that we have not received his cremains, and in the dream it occurs to me that it could simply be another deception, that maybe he's alive after all.
What do you mean, another deception?
Well, like all people who drink and do so while successfully keeping a family and a job, he was an extraordinary magician. The tricks, once found out, of course, were kind of flimsy, but at the time, for so long, they fooled a houseful of naturally sneaky and suspicious people. The most famous trick was the AA trick, which involved attending AA meetings, in our house even, while a few fingers under. It was great. He had gone for about a month to a treatment center somewhere, while we were out east visiting relatives, and when we got home, he was there, sober, dry, triumphant. We were all elated. We felt like we were finally done with all that. Our family was suddenly this clean and new thing, and naturally, because he was sober and strong and everything, he'd conquer the world and bring us with him. We sat on his lap. We worshipped him. Maybe that's a bit strong. I guess in a lot of ways, we still hated and feared him after all the years of yelling and chasing and everything, but still, we were resilient and wanted things to be normal. We were not really sure what normal was, or if we'd ever been a part of it, come to think of it, but we were hopeful nonetheless. And then the meetings, including the one held in our living room. We were supposed to stay in bed, but one time I snuck down and peeked through the stairway's railing and saw all these adults, foggy through all the smoke, and our dad there, in the spot on the couch where he sat on Christmas. It was weird seeing all those adults in the house. Our parents did not entertain. But the point is that he was drinking even then, probably even that night. We never knew. They didn't know. Which is a neat trick, if you think about it. It's a trick I have to respect, being diabolical myself and all. How could he be drinking undetected if he was home all the time? Aha. Yes, there wasn't a bottle in the house. We searched the place. My mom was vigilant. We were too. But you know where it was? It'll make you choke, it's so simple. Every so often, early in the mornings, it was the only time he was really alone and would not rouse suspicion, he would go out, get a bottle of vodka and 4 or 5 liters of quinine, and would bring them home. Then he'd empty out half the quinine containers, fill them with vodka, and then toss all evidence of the vodka. So at night, when we all gathered in the family room watching Three's Company or whatnot, he'd go into the kitchen and, this was a great detail, he'd pour the quinine, vodka, into, instead of the short glasses he used to use, a short glass that would indicate to the casual observer, alcohol, he used a tall glass, and we were fooled. To recap, what goes in the short glass? Alcohol. What goes in the tall glass? A soft drink, of course. Yes, the tall glass is the container of choice for a nice, cool, non-alcoholic beverage. Can you imagine? He must have felt like the cleverest guy in the world, or at least more clever than his dim-witted brood. This went on for about a year, all while we were flush with pride and hope, believing that he had quit and that there would be no more moving for days and weeks at a time to friends' and relatives' houses, no more talk of leaving him, all that. And as we were all rebuilding, all the while, it was incredible. Of course, what's more, with the tall glass, remember, tall glass equals soft drink, he was drinking even more, and we became increasingly confused because while he was ostensibly sober, he was still talking funny after 10, still raging suddenly and implacably, and still falling asleep sitting upright on the couch at 11 every night. So, after he was discovered, he quit? Oh, God, no. My mother went out on the patio, closed the sliding door, and screamed and cried. Her arms wrapped around her shoulders, and there were probably a few threats of leaving, all that. But then, we kind of gave in. My mother was exhausted by him and us. The three of us had recently become 4, and I suppose she conceded that he was going to drink, that he was born to drink, and was quite good at it, by the way, a pretty functional drinker, not a gone-on-a-bender sort, harmless, if not provoked.
So with a new baby, moving or leaving suddenly became far more difficult to do, or even threatened to do. And I imagine at some point our exhausted mother just came to terms with him. This many drinks a night, and no more, blah, blah. And when you think about the lengths he went to deceive us, in the interest, of course, of keeping us from leaving, he would arrange his schedule in really any way at all, would do the flimsy, sad little lies with the quinine and tall glasses, for instance, all so we wouldn't leave. When you think about that, well, he was not perfect, but he was a decent man. And so he reduced his nightly intake after that, readily accepted the truce, drank only beer or wine at home, and as Toph started crawling and then walking, he plateaued. And to tell you the truth, we almost preferred it that way. The whole AA vibe was unsettling, and all those adults in the house, the murmuring and the smoke, it didn't seem appropriate for him. He just wasn't a group sort of guy, buying into all that. In a way, we just didn't want our father to be in AA. He wanted to control or kick it on his own, and that's really the way we preferred it, too. And AA was probably murder for him, with all the references to higher powers and whatnot, the whole gist of which held no water for him. Anyway, after the whole treatment Ghost was given up, it was better then, because it was all out in the open. We knew the exact parameters of him and he of us, and we could then prepare for eventualities, which I had been horrible at doing, never knowing what to expect. See, from when I was very small, I had this wild, horror-infested imagination. It was, for example, my firm belief for a few years that when we went to bed, the downstairs turned into a laboratory for human experimentation, a cross between snippets I'd seen of Coma and Willy Wonka, filled with Oompa Loompa men and bodies in stasis, and that, with even a little of his unevenness, could combine and make chaos and terror where it wasn't necessarily there. I mean, for me, it ended. That thin, brittle rope of trust between a parent and child snapped, probably when I was about 8, with the door thing. Which was... This was when things were a little messy, when he was a little less in control, and I don't remember what the issue was, but I had apparently done something wrong and so was supposed to stand for punishment. You know what was funny? We were, when due punishment, in each instance told to assume the position, meaning to come over and lean over his knees. So quaint. Can you believe it? And of course, I wasn't going to have any part of that garbage. Not that he ever really hit us all that hard. Our mom was the one who really put her weight into it, but there was something terrifying about his fumbling, his clumsy grabbing. It was just so unpredictable because we knew enough to know when he was already blurry, so we just didn't want to be anywhere near his area of... You know that game Octopus? Where you run around trying to get from one side to the other, past all your classmates, and then the red line where they can't touch you, but you can't get near any of the limbs with their little perfect arms suddenly so perilous, so horrifying? It was like that, in a way. A heightened sense of terror born of doubt, a lack of predictability in his behavior. We just did not want to get close enough to him at night for something weird to happen. So with the verdict handed down and the spanking imminent, we ran. Every time we ran and tried to get far enough away and for long enough that, and this was usually more wishful thinking than practical, that his anger would subside or our mother would intervene or both, a reprieve granted. If the episode took place during the day, we'd just run down the street to the park or the creek or our friends and wait it out. But at night, which is when these things usually happened, given we only saw our father, an avid golfer, a few daylight hours each week. Of course we, or at least I, couldn't go outside, being sure that it was much worse out there, the neighborhood being populated with the vampires from Salem's Lot and the William Shatner mask man from Halloween. At night, options were limited to those within the house, which were many, actually, though each with its particular merits and drawbacks. Down in the basement, you could hide in the furnace area or the crawl space, but for the area to be effective, one had to keep the lights off, and one never knew when there would be actual murderers there in the furnace area or crawl space or corpses. Highly possible, of course. Then there were the closets, which were often effective, but in a closet, though one felt warm and safe, one was found so suddenly. The sliding door would whoosh open and hands abruptly there, grabbing. And so the best places were either the upstairs bathroom or one's own bedroom, both of which had simple locks and often held for long enough for things to settle down on the other side. So, on this particular night, I ran to my room, closed and locked the door, and while listening to his bellowing from the bottom of the stairs, this is, by the way, what he did first,
inexplicably demanding that we come down the stairs to allow him to take us with his hands and drag us back to the couch where he would shake us around, get us into position, and then do the whacking. Ludicrous. We did not owe him that. I did not owe him that. Of course not. We never deserved spanking because we were perfect, 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 unassailable. Or if not perfect, at least provoked into whatever it was we did. And so, while in my room, while staring at the door, hyperventilating, I looked around for ideas. I looked at the wallpaper. It was the kind that's actually a huge photograph, mine being an orangey fall forest scene. My mom and I had picked it out, thought it was so beautiful, had sat on the floor staring at it after we put it up. And in my room that night, I wanted to run through it, through the orange forest, because it looked like it went deep, the forest, and it was daylight there besides. But of course, I didn't think of really doing that. I wasn't stupid or delusional, but then looked to another wall, to the unpapered wall over my bed, on which I had drawn, with markers, 20 or so little monsters and happy but still presumably fierce Viking men, all created to protect me as I slept and to come to life in such situations as this. But they were not coming to life. And why were they not coming to life? The yelling continued, and sure that he was still downstairs, I snuck out of my room and into the hall, grabbed the phone and jumped back into my room, sliding the cord underneath and again locking the door. I brought the phone to my bed and called the operator and asked for the area code for Boston. Then I remembered it wasn't Boston, it was Milton, outside Boston. I called for information in Milton, looking for my Aunt Ruth or Uncle Ron. She had done AA. He had been with her. They knew what was what. What should I do? I would ask. They would know. They would intervene. Then the footsteps started coming up the stairs, which they only did some of the time, the times when he was extraordinarily angry and our mother could not calm him down. And as they thumped up the stairs, why did he go so slow, so maddeningly slow? I hung up the phone. I didn't have time now, and devised a plan. I opened the window over my pillow, then tore the sheet off my bed. The footsteps stopped thumping, meaning he was on the second floor, was just 6 or 7 steps from my door. I twisted the sheet so it looked like a rope, or however I had seen it look on TV, and as I began to tie it around the bed frame, there was the trying of the door. Then suddenly, my name so loud, I jumped, then pounding and demands yelled, and if I could just get this thing tied in time. The thumping got louder and louder, and then the sheet was tied, twice over. I yanked it to test its strength, and it seemed okay. It only had to hold for a few seconds, just until I was far enough down to jump. And so I turned my body on my bed and started to scoot back, reaching a leg out to the window, feeling my bare foot against the coarse wood of the side of the house, and then the pounding stopped. I was still lowering myself almost half out the window now. The night was humid. I was able to see the ground, the neighbor's yard, holding the sheet in 2 hands. I paused, breathing quickly like an animal, thinking, wondering if he had been called off. So quiet. And then the door came in, an explosion of wood, and he was upon me. He kicked the door down? Well, he broke it in, broke off the lock and doorknob, half a hinge and everything. Wow. Dramatic, right? Well, yes. And did he then punish you more severely? Not really. When my mom heard the sound of the door breaking, she came running, and so he only had me for a few seconds before she was in the room and he was in trouble. Ultimately, it was kind of vindicating, because this time, like any time we could prove his instability, the extremes of his volatility, I should say, because while sober, he was a pretty normal guy. Funny, even. We felt like we had scored, notched the permanent sort of scorecard that we all kept against him. I used to want to show up to school with bruises, cuts. I knew from after-school specials that that was how it worked. The teacher would see, and then it would finally be out, made semi-public, he'd be given some kind of warning, whatever, and then things would be reined in. So this was a child abuse situation. Oh, God, no. He didn't spank us very hard once he got hold of us. I don't remember it even hurting. Oh. It was my mom who really hit hard. She hit us way more often than he did, but with her, you always sort of knew she had it somewhat under control, though she did say, "I'm gonna kill you," a bit too often for comfort. We'd say something smart-alecky at the dinner table, and she'd stomp over and whack us on the head for a minute, a kind of karate chop maneuver, her muscular brown arm swinging. We'd cover our heads, just flailing to deflect the blows, her long fingers knotted with these huge rings, her mother's. After a while, it was mostly funny. At first, it wasn't funny at all. We'd just lose our shit and run upstairs or run away for a few hours, yelling, "I hate you, I hate you!" Wanting her dead. Wanting a new family, wanting to move in with whatever friend's family we felt was more together. Normal. Of course, in an hour, we'd be sitting in her lap again, happy as clams.
And as we got older, it just got kind of funny. Bill started it, I think, by kind of rolling his eyes and laughing when she'd be karate chopping his head, yelling, "You damn kids!" or whatever. He'd just sit there and take it, let her get tired. Then we kind of followed his lead. We were teenagers at that point and didn't take it all that seriously, kind of let her get her rocks off. And after a while, she started to forget what she was so pissed about in the first place, would be kind of laughing while she hit us. That's a weird sight, I can tell you, watching her laughing, hitting Beth or Bill on the head, saying she was going to kill them, while laughing too. But it does give you a certain flinch mentality, a readiness. You see the hand rise, the stiffness of the wrist, the fingers all together, kung fu style, and of course, we hit each other a lot, too. We kids spent a lot of time devising plans to actually kill each other, throwing each other through windows, downstairs. And so we honestly never knew what to expect, because the various thresholds of violence, as you know, can be and were bridged so suddenly, and once crossed, one seldom goes back, the ante being upped, the terror becoming ever less firma. So we became jittery, overly defensive, at least Beth and I, Bill being older, to the point where if our dad came near us with any corporal intentions, we literally went into a sort of epileptic fit with arms windmilling and legs kicking. We had florid and dark imaginations, I guess. And coupled with enough public service announcement information, some health class statistics and such, in my case, I guess it was my imagination more than anything, my morphing him into the murderers and monsters I nightmared about every night, to a degree that I became convinced that there was a better-than-average chance that, given the wrong set of circumstances, that someday it would be an accident, but that someday he'd kill one of us. That door, for instance, was never fixed, was left with this jagged bite in it for something like 12 more years. We never got around to fixing stuff like that. What did he do for a living again? He was a lawyer, in futures trading. And your mother? A teacher. Reward me for my suffering. Excuse me? Have I given you enough? Reward me. Put me on television. Let me share this with millions. I will do it slowly, subtly, tastefully. Everyone must know. I deserve this. I have this coming. Am I on? Have I broken your heart? Was my story sad enough? It was sad. I know how this works. I give you these things, and you give me a platform. So give me my platform. I am owed. Listen, I can tell you more. I have so many stories. I can tell you about the wigs they wore, the time in the family room, that fall when they both took off their wigs at the same time, that time in the family room knowing it would terrify me, their heads spotted, hair like torn cotton. They laughed, their eyes bright, and the times he fell. I can do last breaths, last words. I have so many things. There is so much symbolism. You should hear the conversations Toph and I have, the things he says. It's wonderful. It's unbelievable. You couldn't script it any better. We talk about death and God, and I have no answers for him. Nothing to help him sleep. No fairy tales. Let me share this. I can do it any way you want, too. I can do it funny or maudlin or just straight, uninflected. Anything. You tell me. I can do it sad or inspirational or angry. It's all there. All these things at once. So it's up to you. You choose. You pick. Give me something. Quid pro quo. I promise I will be good. I will be sad and hopeful. I will be the conduit. I will be the beating heart. Please see this. I am the common multiplier for 47 million. I am the perfect amalgam. I was born of both stability and chaos. I have seen nothing and everything. I'm 24 but feel 10,000 years old. I'm emboldened by youth, unfettered and hopeful, though inextricably tied to the past and future by my beautiful brother who is part of both. Can you not see that we're extraordinary? That we were meant for something else, something more? All this did not happen to us for naught. I can assure you, there is no logic to that. There is logic only in assuming that we suffered for a reason. Just give us our due. I am bursting with the hopes of a generation. Their hopes surge through me, threaten to burst my hardened heart. Can you not see this? I'm at once pitiful and monstrous, I know, and this is all my own making, I know. Not the fault of my parents, but all my own creation, yes. But I am the product of my environment, and thus representative must be exhibited as inspiration and cautionary tale. Can you not see what I represent? I am both A, martyred moralizer, and B, amoral omnivore born of the suburban vacuum, plus idleness, plus television, plus Catholicism, plus alcoholism, plus violence. I am a freak in secondhand velour, a leper who uses L'Oreal anti-sticky mega gel. I am rootless, ripped from all foundations, an orphan raising an orphan and wanting to take away everything there is and replace it with stuff I've made. I have nothing but my friends and what's left of my little family. I need community. I need feedback. I need love, connection, give and take. I will bleed if they will love. Let me try. Let me prove. I will pluck my hair. I will remove my skin. I will stand before you feeble and shivering. I will open a vein, an artery. Pass over me at your peril. I could die soon. I probably already have AIDS or cancer. Something bad will happen to me, I know. I know this because I have seen it so many times. I will be shot in an elevator. I will be swallowed in a sinkhole. Will drown, so I need to bring this message now. I only have so much time. I know that sounds ridiculous. I seem young, healthy, strong, but things happen. I know you may not think so, but things happen to me, to those around me. They truly do. You'll see? So I need to grab this while I can, because I could go at any minute. Laura, mother, father, God... Let me be the conduit. There are all these hearts, and mine is strong. And if there are capillaries that bring blood to millions, that we all are of one body, and that I am... Oh, I want to be the heart pumping blood to everyone. Blood is what I know. I feel so warm in blood, can swim in blood. Oh, let me be the strong beating heart that brings blood to everyone. I want... And that will heal you? Yes, 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 yes!